Sorry, Amber.
No, that's good. It's good to let everyone know that this conference is being recorded. So consider that as you are asking your questions, and we will consider that in our presentation. So our process, though, is to ensure that the report that's delivered and all the products that we deliver are credible and that they're responsive to the questions that we are asked. And again, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory has been a strong partner in this, not only for all the elements that are on the slide that you see before you, but because they are they're recognized as a highly effective energy lab, and more to the point, they do state-of-the-art research on well stimulation technologies and their impacts. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Jane Long, who is the scientific lead overall for the study, and she's going to tell you a little bit about the process of convening the steering committee and go into the findings of the report.
Good afternoon. I'd like to draw your attention to the steering committee for this study. These are people from throughout the state as well as outside the state that represent a variety of expertise, of technical expertise and scientific expertise relevant to hydraulic fracturing. The role of the steering committee was to steer the report and to review the contents and to push the direction towards answering questions that are relevant to the problem and as well assessing that the answers were as scientifically defensible as possible. The basis of our assessment started with the report that we did for the Bureau of Land Management that was completed last August, and that report answered three questions, basically what is happening in the state relevant to hydraulic fracturing onshore, and what could happen in the future, and what are the impacts. Building on that report, we are, to say that this report also used available data, peer-reviewed literature, and the expertise of the committee. We did solicit nominations for literature from the public and got many that we found were able to contribute to the report. Discussed that, I'm sorry. The current study that we're going to talk about today is for the state of California, and it is divided into three volumes plus a summary report. The first volume that we're going to talk about today that is being released today is Well Stimulation Technologies and Their Past, Present, and Potential Future Use in California. The second volume, third volume, and a summary report will come out on July 1st. Second volume will look at impacts, environmental impact of these well stimulation technologies, and volume three will look at case studies, particular case studies. So the volume two impacts that we're going to release in July will be looking at water and air impacts, induced seismicity, traffic, noise, light, human health, and ecological and hazard analysis. We will take all of these impacts and begin to unravel what we know about them, what we don't know about them, the data gaps, as well as alternative practices that could ameliorate or prevent various impacts. Volume three, the case studies volume, will be focused on four different areas of the state. They are going to be issue-oriented. So in Los Angeles, we're going to look at the issues that occur of having hydraulic fracturing and other well stimulation activities occur in an urban environment. We'll focus a little bit more there on acid use, which has been a topic of public concern. And we are going to look at what it would take to develop some of these source rock clays that have been so controversial elsewhere in an urban environment compared to producing oil in the existing reservoirs in this urban environment. In the San Joaquin Valley, where almost all the oil production is, the large majority of the oil production in the state occurs today, and where the vast majority of hydraulic fracturing occurs today in the state of California, we'll be looking at how these issues will play out in the future because we think this is the region where is most likely to have the majority of hydraulic fracturing in the future. there's been a lot of study of, or a lot of concern about the potential of the Monterey Formation to produce oil from deep source rocks, and one of our studies will then look at what the real potential will be. As you'll hear from Preston in a few minutes, there have been two estimates by the Energy Information Agency about the potential of the Monterey Formation to produce oil, and one of those estimates is very high, one of those estimates is very low. We're going to look at what it would really take to get a good estimate. We think both of those estimates are not substantiated with data, and we'll also look at the footprint of that formation and look at some of the impacts that could occur if it ever was produced. Finally, the offshore case study will just try to accumulate everything that we know about what's actually happening offshore. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Preston, and he's going to talk about Volume 1. Volume 1 has three parts. It has the first chapter, first chapter is the introduction. Chapter 2 is about the actual technologies, how they're used, what makes them work, conditions they can operate under. We'll talk a little bit about that today, but mostly we're going to talk about Chapter 3 and 4. Chapter 3 actually looks at the practice of well stimulation technology in California, how, when, where, why it's used, how much it's used, and then Chapter 4 is its likely future. So with that, I turn it over to Preston, who's going to give you a very good presentation on those topics.
Thank you, Dr. Long. I expect that most in the audience on the line know about hydraulic fracturing in terms of what it affects as a process. But just as a brief recap, there's some more detail on that on the lower right portion of the slide that's showing, which shows some of the different operational aspects of performing hydraulic fracture. But in brief, it involves injecting a pressurized fluid into a well under sufficient pressure to cause a fracture to form and then propagate in a rock, and then introducing sand or a proppant into that fluid in order to hold the fracture open once the pressure is released so that the rock doesn't collapse back and close that fracture off. Hydraulic fracturing can be performed with a number of different volumes. So small volume hydraulic fracture is called a frac pack sometimes. And the purpose of that is really to break through the damage that occurs due to drilling the well itself. So the drilling muds when the well is these small fractures can go through that clogging and access the portion of the reservoir beyond. Intermediate volume hydraulic fractures have been used for decades. They were first used in California starting in 1953. I think they were first used in the United States in the Midwest in 1947. High-volume fractures are typically used in horizontal wells. They're not typically used in California, and that is, for the most part, what is being referred to as hydraulic fracturing in the media at this time, and is being used extensively in other parts of the country. And then finally, acid fracturing is used in some other parts of the country. Acid and acid fracturing is used instead of a proppant. So instead of introducing a physical granular material into the fluid that will hold the fracture open once the pressure is relieved, the acid is introduced, and that etches or dissolves parts of the rock along the fracture, so when the fracture closes, there are still some gaps through which oil can flow to the well. That generally is only effective in carbonate rocks, such as limestone, because they dissolve relatively quickly, and those rocks are not common in California, and so this technology is not used hardly at all in California. The image on the left shows the practice that is typically being reported on in the media now and occurring extensively throughout the rest of the country. It's a vertical well progressing through a number of strata down to the target strata into which it turns horizontally. And there are a number of fracture stage or fracture operations that are conducted in that well to extensively fracture the rock around that well in that horizontal layer. The image on the right is more typical for what is occurring in California. It's shallower wells, hundreds of meters instead of thousands of meters, vertical wells for the most part, and the fracturing is generally more simple, which I'll explain, try to explain here with the next slide. The image on the left shows a typical California application. The goal in California often is to create a single fracture propagating out from the well, or at least out from a point in the well where that fracture operation is performed. The reason for that is that the rocks that are fractured in California, for the most part, are at the higher end of the permeability range where fracturing is performed. Fracturing still needs to be performed because the rock permeability is too low to allow the oil to flow to the well sufficiently, but it's at the higher end of that range. And the goal is to create a single fracture that will allow the oil to flow through the rock and then to the well. This contrasts with fracturing in other parts of the country of what's called source rock, which I'll say more about later. The permeability of that rock is very low, and so the goal of the fracturing is to create permeability out throughout the rock mass by creating a complex fracture network. The volume of water that's required to make the single fracture that's typical in California is much less than the volume of water needed to make that complex fracture network that is common in the rest of the country. Also, the volume of water, chemical concentration of the water that is required to carry the sand into the fracture in California to hold that fracture open is a higher concentration than the concentrations used in water in other parts of the country. The reason for that is because in California, in creating that single fracture, the goal is to create one wide fracture that essentially acts as a highway for the oil to get to the well. And in order to carry that mass of sand, the viscosity of the water needs to be increased substantially. Otherwise, the sand will just fall out in the well before going out into the rock. And so in order to increase that viscosity, a number of chemicals are added to affect that goal. Whereas the water that's used, or the fluids that are used in the rest of the country, they use much lower loads of sand per volume of water, and they use a lesser amount of chemicals per volume of water, mostly actually to make the water flow more easily, given the volumes that they're injecting. So now to put some data behind this. This graph shows across the bottom axis is the volume of water used per hydraulic fracturing operation. And the vertical axis is the frequency of water of operations that occur with that particular water use. Each red dot in this represents one particular operation. So this presents a distribution of the water volume used in operations in California specifically. The average for California is about 140,000 gallons per operation. As it says on the bottom here, that the average in the rest of, or in some other locations in the country, is over 1 million gallons per operation, so it's substantially different from California. And another point of reference is provided by New York State's definition of high-volume hydraulic fracturing, which it considers 300,000 gallons and above per operation as high volume, and 300,000 gallons and below as low as not high volume. There have been a few high volume hydraulic fracturing operations that have been reported to have occurred in California. In order to get some perspective on how successful those have been, we looked up the production records for those operations. So in other words, the well was fractured, and then it was put on production. The oil production is reported to the state, and that's in the state database, and we access that data. Along the bottom of this graph is the months since production started for a particular well. Now the vertical axis is the oil production. In the scale on the right is barrels per day. And what's shown is the statistics for 13 of the operations that used more than 1 million gallons to fracture the well. There were 15 in total, but we could find production records for 13. And the upper line is the maximum from all those wells, the maximum production from all those wells. You can see in the first few months it was a little over 100 barrels a day, and then it declined within a year to near 20 barrels a day. The mean and the median from all the wells was considerably less, starting at around 30 to 40 barrels a day and declining to near 10 barrels a day. This contrasts with the high-volume hydraulic fracturing production that's typical in other parts of the country. For instance, in the Bakken Formation, the initial production in the first month after fracturing is often 10 times this amount. So it'll approach 500 barrels per day, even 1,000 barrels per day in the first month. So this indicates that to the extent hydraulic fracturing has been deployed in California, it has not had the same result that it has had in other parts of the country. One of the other big questions we were faced with was trying to understand more about the history of the use of hydraulic fracturing in a quantitative sense in California. We were able to get some perspective on that by searching through a statistical sample of the state's well records. And the results of that work is shown on this slide. So across the bottom of this graph are different time periods going back more than a decade. And on the vertical axis are the number of wells annually per year that are installed in each of those time periods. The colored region in the bottom is the number of wells that were identified as hydraulically fractured in the well records annually. And so the key message of this graph is that the number of wells that have been hydraulically fractured over the last year, over the last decade, has not appreciably gone up year over year. It has increased a little bit, but so has the number of wells that have been installed overall. So there has not been a large shift to hydraulic fracturing as compared to wells that are not hydraulically fractured. In order to estimate the rate at which hydraulic fracturing is occurring, though, we could not rely on well records alone because there was no requirement at the time that operators report hydraulic fracturing in the well record. So we looked at a number of data sets that were available over a more recent time period and intersected those data sets to try to determine the consistency between them. What this figure represents is each of the colored boxes represents one or more data sets that we looked at. The overlap between the boxes represents when a well was shown as being hydraulically fractured in both data sets or more than one data set. So you can see there's a reasonably high level of consistency between all the data sets, which increased confidence that our understanding was fairly accurate of the amount of hydraulic fracturing that was occurring in the state. Taking all these data sets into consideration indicated about 110 hydraulic fracture events per month in the state. When we looked at the notices that are coming in under SB4, even that appeared to be a moderate underreport. The most recent or relatively recent notice count that's come into the state indicates an estimate of about 150 hydraulic fractures per month is probably more accurate. And we don't expect that to change appreciably with future data. It may change in the details. It might be 125. It might be 175, but it's a reasonably accurate, if not precise, number. What this graph shows is categories of stimulation that we looked at across the bottom. I've been talking about hydraulic fracturing and frac packing to this point. We were also tasked with looking at matrix acidizing and acid fracturing, which I've also mentioned. This shows the estimate of the rates at which those are occurring per month in various geographic domains within the state. So the left three columns are for onshore for each of the three types of stimulation. The middle is in state waters, which is water within operations within 3 nautical miles of the coastline. And the right two columns are in federal waters, which are controlled by the federal government beyond that 3 nautical mile limit. What's apparent from this slide is that hydraulic fracturing onshore is by far the vast majority of the stimulation that takes place in the state. The data that was available indicates matrix acidizing operations occur about 10% as frequently is hydraulic fracturing. This inset shows a blow-up of the right five columns. So you can see those rates more easily. They're all quite small, showing acid fracturing onshore is quite small. State waters, maybe one operation per month for hydraulic fracturing. We didn't find any evidence of matrix acidizing in state waters. Federal waters we have less clarity about because of the record keeping by the federal government and the searches that we were able to perform were not of the same level as what we could do with the state records. But nonetheless, it indicated very little activity in federal waters. For onshore hydraulic fracturing in California, almost all of it occurs in the San Joaquin Valley. And in the San Joaquin Valley, almost all of that occurs in just four fields in the southwestern part of the San Joaquin Valley. 85% of the fracturing in the state occurs in those four fields, through Lost Hills, North and South Bell Ridge, and Elk Hills. And all the reported matrix acidizing occurs in just three fields in the same area, which are Elk Hills, Railroad Gap, and Buena Vista. One of the reasons there isn't much activity offshore, and there's a variety of reasons for this, is that operationally it's more difficult to conduct a hydraulic fracture offshore. On the lower right is a picture of a hydraulic fracturing operation showing some of the equipment that is involved. And on the upper left is obviously an oil platform. And the difficulty presented by mobilizing all the equipment on the lower right into a location on the upper left is perhaps somewhat clear. We did look at data from the entire state. We looked at well records from across the entire state and other data sets that covered the entire state, including the northern part of the state where natural gas production is more predominant, although most of the natural gas production in the state does not occur in the north. What hydrocarbon production does occur in the north is gas production. And we did not find any appreciable well stimulation taking place in association with just natural gas production. There were some hydraulic fracturing events that occurred in the Sacramento Valley, but relatively few. This image shows oil production and gas production in the different basins in Central and Southern California. A basin is a depression of the earth that has accumulated sediment from which oil has been generated and trapped over time. And the green circle represents relative oil production between the different basins, and the red represents relative gas production between the different basins. The light portions of these circles represents the portion of that production that is attributable to hydraulic fracturing, and the dark of the, from fields where hydraulic fracturing is not occurring. And in general, we find about one-fifth of the oil production in the state is associated with hydraulic fracturing. And I think another important contextual statement here is California produces about a third of petroleum that it consumes, and so it imports about two-thirds of the petroleum that it consumes. This image shows the distribution of fracturing depths, looking at different data sets. So each set of colored bars here is from a different data set. The horizontal axis is different depth ranges, and the vertical axis is the fraction of hydraulic fracturing operations that occurred in that depth range. And overall, looking at the different data sets, about three-quarters of hydraulic fracturing occurs less than 600 meters deep in the state. And this is quite different than other parts of the country where hydraulic fracturing tends to take place thousands of meters deep, and so quite substantial depth relative to shallow, usable groundwater. In California, this raises the concern that hydraulic fracturing might be occurring in closer proximity to usable groundwater. This map shows that the shallowest depth of fracturing in various fields in the state, with the fields, oil fields shown in blue, having the deepest fractures, over 2,400 meters deep, and the fields with shown in red having the shallowest fractures with fracturing shallower than 300 meters or 1,000 feet. So you can see that there are fields in the southwestern part of the San Joaquin Valley and also the eastern part of the San Joaquin Valley that have quite shallow hydraulic fracture that has occurred. As I mentioned, we've also looked at matrix acidizing. There were not as many data sets that bore upon this stimulation method as there were for hydraulic fracturing. It shares some similarities to hydraulic fracturing in terms of that it occurs in somewhat operational phases. The acidizing that occurs in California typically involves hydrochloric and hydrofluoric acid mixed because the rocks that occur here are not amenable to dissolution with just hydrochloric acid, as are rocks in some other parts of the country. We found that the reported matrix acidizing was about a tenth as often as the reported hydraulic fracturing. However, there is a data set out there, the South Coast Air Quality Management District data set, that includes data on all use of acid, not just matrix acidizing. This is a map that shows by these circles all the acid jobs that were reported to the South Coast Air Quality Management District, both by the volume of acid that was injected, which is done by the size of the open circle, and the concentration of the acid that was injected, which is by the color of the closed circle. You can see that these operations tend to be focused on just a few fields. Well, looking at that data set allowed us to do was to try to come to some understanding of SB4 separates out matrix acidizing from maintenance acidizing. Maintenance acidizing uses smaller volumes of acid with the goal of dissolving precipitates in the well. So in other words, when fluids are being produced from a well, if the fluid comes into the well, that its condition might change such that solid materials that are dissolved in the water precipitate out onto the well and can cause damage to the well. And so periodically, acid might be introduced into the well to dissolve that material and restore the well's function. Those volumes are generally smaller than matrix acidizing. SB4 excludes maintenance acidizing from its requirements. So we were interested to see, is there a clear distinction between maintenance and matrix acidizing? And this figure is helped us to try to gain some perspective on that question. The horizontal axes are the total volume that's used in the South Coast Air Quality Management District acid jobs, and the vertical axis is the concentration of acid used in those jobs. 2013 operations are shown in the red crosses, and 2014 operations are shown in the blue diamonds. The dashed lines are somewhat indicative of different regulatory definitions of matrix acidizing. The horizontal line is at the 7% acid concentration, which was a cutoff in the interim regulations. And so this graph shows that there were a number of operations in 2014 that fell above that line, and so potentially could be matrix acidizing. Under the proposed final regulations, it's a volumetric threshold that's predicated on if fluid moves out more than a meter from the well, it will be considered matrix acidizing. And the vertical line is just an example for a well that's approximately 4,600 feet deep with a 100-foot-long treatment interval. What would the volume of that be? Where would that fall? And again, there's a number of operations that fall to the right of that. So based on this, we could not discern that there was a clear bimodal distribution or a clear differentiation between maintenance and matrix acidizing. And so going forward in the other volumes, we will be considering all acid use, particularly because it appears that to the extent there is hazard associated with acid use, it probably accrues to the handling of the acid at the surface rather than its fate in the subsurface.
Preston, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Apparently, some of the folks listening over the computers are experiencing a little bit of an audio delay.
Okay.
So if you can just pause for a second or two when you advance the slide,
sure.
It'll give the audio a chance to catch up with the slides.
Okay.
As much as possible.
Yeah.
I'm also recommending that people just use their phones rather than the audio over the computer. But a few people are having difficulty.
Thanks. Yeah, and I apologize for those troubles. I knew there was some delay on the visual side, and then when I heard there was delay on the audio side, I thought, well, maybe the delays will match and we'll be in luck, but
we weren't. Apparently the delay in the audio is much bigger.
Okay.
Good That's thing we have a delay on the video.
Kind of a surprise, right? I would have thought it would go the other way. So until this moment, I've been talking about the past and present of stimulation practice and occurrence in California. This will discuss these next slides will discuss the perspective on stimulation practice as it might be applied in the future. So in this map image, the extent of the Monterey Formation is shown in green with regard to the extent of the San Joaquin Basin, which is shown in this light blue color. However, not the entire Monterey Formation is host to petroleum resources, or is subject to well stimulation. The portion that is perhaps of most interest, given what I'll discuss on the next slide, is what's called the source rock. So in a petroleum system or a basin that has petroleum, The requisite ingredients are that a rock was deposited that had a very high carbon content. That rock was subsequently buried to a sufficient depth such that it reached a temperature that caused that carbon to turn into oil. And then in the case of California, that oil migrated or floated upward into other strata, sandstone layers, where it was trapped and has been produced for the last century. What is being developed through high-volume hydraulic fracturing in other parts of the country, such as North Dakota, Texas, and Pennsylvania, is the source rock itself, and that has not occurred in California. This map shows these air portions of the Monterey. This map shows the portions of the Monterey that are in that source rock window in orange and magenta. You can see it's a portion of the basin. There were some estimates that were put out by the Energy Information Administration in 2011. An estimate was put out that that source rock, the amount of volume of recoverable oil from that source rock was 15 billion barrels. And in reviewing that estimate, we could not find data that underpinned the assumptions that were made, but each of the assumptions that was made was on the high side, some on the quite high side. In 2014, the Energy Information Administration issued a new estimate, and it had reduced its estimate for source rock oil from the Monterey down to 600 million barrels, which is more than a 90% reduction. At the same time, it increased its estimate from the rest of the country. So whereas in 2011, most of the source rock oil in the country was estimated to be in California, now almost none of it is. We don't necessarily think that either of these answers is credible based on the data or lack of data that underpins it, but it goes to the uncertainty of the information that's behind it. That said, in California, the conventional resources, the oil fields that have been developed for over a century, have considerably more oil available in them and seem to be the most likely targets for continued production in the future. As that production currently involves well stimulation, it seems highly likely that that production will continue to use well stimulation. I think with that, we'll wrap up and take questions.
Thanks, Preston.
Sure.
So, do we have questions from the audience?
Well, we had one simple logistic question that a few people were asking, which is whether or not the presentation will be made available later. And I just wanted to let people know that we will be posting it on CCSD's website, both a PDF of the slides and a recording.
Yes, question in the audience.
Do I have to be on mic?
It'd be nice, actually.
You can repeat the question.
Okay, I'll repeat the question.
I think your second or third slide showed the difference in horizontal, typical, vertical, horizontal in the state. Can you go back to that slide? It shows in California, and here's what we do, and it shows, I'll hold the question until you get to the slide. It was early. There it is. In this slide, the right slide is what you're saying is typical of California.
Correct.
Where it shows an injection well and a production well. To me, that looks like a typical enhanced oil recovery slide. Where's the fracture taking place?
So it can occur in either.
Question.
Oh, sorry. So the question was, yeah, so the question is on the right-hand side of the slide, which shows the typical situation in California. Question is, where is the hydraulic, that the arrangement of the wells looks like an enhanced oil recovery arrangement where there is injection and production going on from different wells. So one well is used to inject usually water or steam, and the other well produces the oil. So in a lot of the fracked reservoirs that are being produced in California, both the injection and the production wells are being fracked. So it can be the case. As well, in California, gas storage facilities use hydraulic fracturing. So hydraulic fracturing isn't confined in California either to just production wells. It can be both. So in a reservoir where you are using enhanced oil recovery, you can also use fracking.
So, repeat your answer is both, or what I just learned is both the production well might be fracked initially, and injection wells, you need a stream of water flooding, they might fracture
right.
That sooner to
get more right. The flood. Right. So, hydraulic fracturing is used often in other states, it's used for groundwater wells. Particularly in New England, groundwater wells are hydrofracked and granitic, mostly in granite rock. In California, we mostly hydrofracture the production wells, but we also hydrofracture injection wells. And we also hydrofracture wells that are used to pump gas underground in order to store it. So if you want to be able to pump more gas underground to store it and then pull it up when you need it, you pump it when you put it underground when you get it, and you pull it out as you need it. So you pull it out more in the winter when you need more heat, put more in the summer when you don't need it, then those wells are also being hydraulically fractured. You can come up here.
But it just maybe if you ask your questions, Jane can repeat them.
It's a little harder, but I'd be happy to have you come up. Yeah, and just say.
This little one right here.
This is Bill Alio with the Environmental Working Group asking questions. So maybe Jason Marshall, the Department of Conservation, needs to answer this, maybe not. So when someone fractures an injection well that is permitted under the Underground Injection Control Program, is that well reported pursuant to Senate Bill 4 mandates?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and answer. I'll repeat.
The answer to the question is yes. If there was a well that was part of the UIC project and the operator was going to entertain hydraulic fracturing, means simulating the formation as a part of that overall project, they would have to go through both the UIC permitted, but also through the WNC permitted.
Right. So hydrofracture has to be permitted whether it's used for injection or production.
And have we seen pursuant to reporting pursuant to SB 4 so far, have we seen both initial production wells and injection wells fractured, stimulated?
Yes. Well, I think Pratt's thinking give you a firm answer since he's looked at the data, but I think the answer is yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So you wanted to know if SB 4 records are showing both injection wells and production wells.
I don't know that the notice is specified whether it's an injection or production well. I can tell you that looking in the well records, I was able to identify injection wells that have been fractured looking in the well records. You might have to sort of.
Question. Bill, the question about whether there were wells in 2014.
You need to come up here if you're going to.
Quick point of clarification question for Mr. Elliott. Bill, is the question whether there were wells in 2014 or historically that were part of UIC projects that also had WST going on?
An answer to both would be good. So, you know, 20 years ago versus since you started voluntary disclosure and now mandatory disclosure under SB4.
I think in both cases we'd have to go back and take a look at the records. I think that Preston's research will probably make him more equipped to answer the pre-2014 because he's actually the one who combed through those records. But with regard to post-2014, we could certainly look through those and determine whether any of those wells were participating in both WST permitting and UIC permitting.
So I don't have the answer immediately at hand.
So one of the appendices to the report is a compendium of approximately 5,000 wells that have been stimulated in that have been hydraulically fractured in California. From all the different data sets that we looked at. And part of that table is the first production and or first injection date for each well. So if you look at that table, you'll be able to see wells that were injected at any time that had also been stimulated at some point in time.
Okay. My next question is regarding a slide about volumes of chemicals. Can you bring that slide up, please?
This one you're talking about?
No.
Next one.
Has a graph. Yeah, there we go.
This one?
Yeah.
That's about water. It's not about chemicals.
You're right. Maybe you were discussing under the slide the percent of chemicals, and you said that California generally uses larger percentage by volume of chemicals. Nationally, the industry says we only use less than 1% of the total volume of chemicals. So in a million-gallon frack job, only 10,000 gallons are benzene and other chemicals. So not the sand, not the water, but the chemicals. So in California, if a well is 100,000, what percent are chemicals? So if it's 50%, that's 50,000 gallons of chemicals. versus a frack job in Marcellus Shale, which might only be 5 or 10,000 gallons, even though it's 10 times the volume of water?
Well, I think that's the answer. It's because it's 10 times the volume of water. I mean, the, what we're saying is that the frack fluids are more concentrated, right? But we use a lot less water. So if you multiply the concentration times the volume, you get the amount of chemicals, right?
Right.
But,
it's more like 2% in California, so it's not that dramatic a difference. So
that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
But what percent is it?
Yeah, so overall the chemical use, the absolute volume and mass of chemicals that's used per operation in California would be less than in used in other parts of the country. It's more concentrated, but it's a lower mass. It's also different chemicals because it's a different kind of hydraulic fracture fluid. It's a gel fluid instead of slick water or
hydrate. So the difference in the nature of the frack, the many small fractures versus the larger ones with a larger aperture, it turns out we're way different in California, yet chemical use-wise, it's not that different in terms of percent of, you know.
Well, I think
2% instead of 1%.
Right, so it's a higher, well, it's a matter of perspective, I guess, being a technologist. You know, we're always, I guess, overly focused on the details, maybe. So for us, it looked like a difference, but in terms of the overall mass, maybe it isn't that big a difference.
Okay, I have a couple of questions from the web here that we can read. Is this one?
I can go skip.
Okay. So we have a question from a web viewer. What data is being used to estimate? What data is being used to estimate the reserves in California since the EI estimates are not trusted? Pat, are you on the phone?
He's not.
Okay, then I'll
well, I can say a word about that.
I'll say a couple words and then I'll let you do that. So the U.S. Geological Survey has been involved in extensive studies of what the reserves are in reservoirs that have been produced for a long time in California. And those estimates are fairly robust. They're based on a lot of data about previous success with production at all these reservoirs, what the geology is like nearby, what likely reserves are remaining. So those estimates are fairly, you can be fairly confident. And they're also presented in ranges and based on transparent data. The EIA estimates are that we were referring to are EIA estimates of only the source rock plays, in other words, these deep shales that have not been extensively produced in California. And that is what we are saying is not, I wouldn't say they're not to be trusted. I wouldn't use those words. I'd just say that they're based on very little data. And so it's not clear that those estimates should be relied on to develop policies about what will happen in California. We need more information about those possible reserves to possible potential for production in those formations before we should be concerned that there's going to be production in the next few years. So you want to add to that?
I just want to emphasize that the EIA's estimate was for source rock reserves. The USGS estimates are for what's called conventional oil, or oil that's migrated away from the source rock and been trapped. So they're estimating reserves of different portions of the geologic system. And the source rock, there's much less data. There's been much less exploration, so there's much greater uncertainty. USGS also brought to bear statistical tools and knowledge that EIA has not brought to bear. And so while the slide shows a single estimate from USGS of reserves, in fact, if you go to their the references, the papers, which I believe are cited on that slide, they actually present a probabilistic range of reserves, so the 10% likelihood, 50% likelihood, 90% likelihood.
I have another question here. Can we elaborate on the conventional versus unconventional fracking? Moderate volume in a vertical, I guess these are some notes, your notes.
My notes are that I think from some further notes from the questioner, I think what they were asking about is the distinction between fracking with a moderate volume in a vertical well versus very high volume fracking that's seen mostly outside of California. I think they're asking about that.
Okay, so to say again, so in California, we have reservoirs with rocks that already have a certain amount of permeability. In other words, they're already conductive, but they're not conductive enough to produce oil. So the goal is to produce a hydrofracture that connects those fractures to the well. So we don't need a big fracture network. We already have one. So what we want to produce is a is basically something that makes the reservoir look like it has a great big well, so it's easier to contact more of the rock. So we produce a single big fracture that's opened up and held open by sand, by proppant. In the rocks that are being produced back east, they the geometry of the well is different, because the formations that form these, that form the reservoirs are, if you like, exaggerating a little bit, they're kind of like pancakes. And so you can drill extensively along the reservoir, contact lots of reservoir rock with a horizontal well that can be very long. But that means you have to fill up that whole well with fluid in order to get enough fluid down to the place you want to produce hydrofractures from. And furthermore, you don't want just one fracture. You want a whole big network of fractures, so you have to put more fluid in, force more fluid in to open up a lot more fractures. That means that the types of fluids you use and the amounts of fluids you use to do hydrofracturing are quite different. Do you have any more questions from the web?
So it just occurred to me maybe a way to categorize this is think of sort of three different rock types that contain oil. So one rock type has sufficient permeability for the oil to migrate into it over geologic time and sufficient permeability for the oil to be produced out of it by a well without fracturing. The next rock has lower permeability, but the permeability is high enough for the oil to migrate in over geologic time, which can be millions of years, but the permeability is too low for the oil to be produced from a well on our time scale. A year or 10 years. And so that well needs hydraulic fracturing. That's the kind of wells that are being hydraulically fractured in California. The third type is a rock type that the permeability is too low for the oil to migrate out of, and the permeability is too low to get that oil out of. And the oil is in that rock because it started in that rock. And those are the rocks that are being fractured in the rest of the country. And the permeability of those rocks is so low that they need the network of fractures imposed on them. So that's why they need the more extensive fracture networks, because the permeability is so low.
What's Bakken Shale?
So that's source rock.
That would be the third
type. That would be the third type,
yeah. We have about 3 minutes left, so the remaining questions we'll get to as many as we can, and we'll have as brief answers as we can deliver.
Okay, so we're just going to give a very brief answer to, we got a question about what frac packing was compared to fracturing. And then there's another question about acid stimulation that Jason's going to answer. Are you going to answer that? Are you going to answer that one?
I don't have an
answer for that. Okay. All right. So I'll give the question. So I'm just very briefly going to give a quick answer to this first question, and then we'll give you the second question until you were going to get an answer. Okay. So the first question was, what is frac packing? This has been described by industry as a hybrid of hydraulic fracturing and gravel packing. So I think that one way to think about frac packing is that it's a small hydraulic fracture. And then it's used to essentially prevent sand from getting into the well. It's kind of, they do a small fracture, and then that fracture provides a way for fluid to get around damaged areas in the well. We included in our study, but we are not, because it is essentially a hydraulic fracture, but you can think of this as small, medium, and large. And California, the vast majority of things that are happening in California are the medium-sized from vertical wells, and we're not doing the very large fractures from horizontal wells. Second question here, the last one that we'll address, and I'm not sure we're going to address it. You have something you want to say? Okay. Do you have a sense of what percent of all acid stimulation jobs in California are excluded from the definition used by SC4 Dogger, i.e. acid stimulation that would be considered maintenance?
The short answer would be no. We couldn't tell you exactly how many of the uses of acid in a given year will or will not trip that threshold that is in SB4. SB4 and the author and the legislature plainly drew a distinction between well maintenance and formation stimulation, and asked us to put together a sort of a threshold, which is in the regulations. That is one of the provisions of the regs, though, that is specifically called out for further evaluation. I have forgotten exactly the timeline, but it's a couple of years out, where the department is expected to go back, take a look at its experience in regulating the practice, and identify whether the threshold that has been drawn is adequate. I know that the council in some of its discussions was also trying to figure out where is that threshold, or is there a threshold distinction between well maintenance and formation stimulation. I think it's going to be subject to further discussion as we lead up to whatever changes we recommend pursuant to SB4.
Yeah, I think you saw from Preston that we couldn't find a threshold in the data that would show you that here's a great big use of asset or here's a small, and these are all small. Also, we think that we're charged with looking at the impacts, and we think since the impacts are basically at the surface, we're just going to look at the handling of assets on at the surface. And that depends on their volume. The impacts will depend on their volume and their concentration, how much they're being moved around, what kind of worker exposure might be occurring. So that's what we think the major issue is. We don't think the major issue is what happens after you put the acid in the ground, in the well, unless you are pulling it back up quickly, in which case it hasn't all been neutralized, and then again, it's still a surface problem. So with that, I think we're going to shut down.
Yes. Thank you so much, all of you who are able to join us. And if we weren't able to answer your questions, we have another opportunity at a public meeting on February 3rd at CSU Bakersfield, located in Bakersfield, California, from 6 to 8 p.m. And we also, as a reminder, will be posting this webinar and the recording and the slides on our website. So if you'd like more details about the public meeting in Bakersfield, that will also be posted on our website and sent to those who logged into this call with their email. We will add you to our distribution list. Thank you so much. Have a good day.